This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. What started as an unofficial competition sponsored by a handful of local businessmen has grown into a massive charitable event that brings thousands of dollars to Eastern North Carolina. Lee Jenkins takes a look into the history and impact of the Big Rock Blue Marlin Tournament.
In 1957, five businessmen wanted to attract customers to Carteret County. To that end, they created a sort of unofficial tournament for the local charter fleet to compete in. The challenge? Catch a blue marlin. The prize? $250. Since then, the competition has evolved into the Big Rock, one of the largest fishing tournaments on the East Coast. Over the years, the tournament, named for a reef that serves as a popular fishing ground for marlin, has hit quite a few milestones. Big Rock director Crystal Hesmer began working with the tournament during one of those milestone moments.
We reached $1 million. That was a huge, huge deal to everybody involved, including those that had started the tournament. The little boy that pulled the original $250 was also alive, but still had the bag with some of the silver dollars still in it. As a matter of fact, he gave me one and I wear it around my neck.
So far, Big Rock's managed to avoid any big controversy, thanks in part to its conservative catch-and-release policy. Only the very biggest fish make the cut.
Our tournament minimum is 400 pounds or 110 inches. 99 inches is a federal government minimum. We have about a 96% release rate.
Aside from the 2010 incident, in which a mate aboard the vessel Citation was disqualified for not having a coastal recreational fishing license, the Big Rock tournament usually goes off without a hitch. Fishermen and spectators alike enjoy the competition.
People plan their vacations around the tournament. Somebody said, we were all bored, nothing was happening, and finally we got the Big Rock pop.
The tournament isn't just about catching fish or drawing in crowds, though. It's also about making generous donations to charities. Hesmer says Big Rock board members felt it was necessary that the tournament support local nonprofits.
Originally, it was set up so that it would bring people to Carteret County. The businessmen, of course, wanted to increase their business. But as the tournament grew in success, members of the board at the time and current members feel that it's our duty to give the money back to the community.
And give back they have. Since 1988, Big Rock has donated over $3 million to area charities, such as Carabel's Station Club Enterprise for the Intellectually Disabled and Martha's Mission Cupboard. According to Edie Reed, executive director of the Broad Street Free Clinic, donations from the tournament go a long way towards keeping the clinic open.
These days it's tighter and tighter to get grant money for just operating expenses, so Big Rock money is real important to just help with the day-to-day costs.
Thanks to the support of benefactors like Big Rock, as well as a handful of volunteers and professionals willing to donate their time, the clinic has provided free medical care to hundreds of less fortunate Carteret County citizens, ranging from dentistry to checkups and pharmaceuticals. While the Broad Street Free Clinic helps those without medical coverage, the Hope Mission reaches out to those without a place to call home. Executive Director Gene McLendon.
Hope Mission was started in the late 80s to address the need of those who were homeless, providing a place for them to stay, providing a meal for those who were hungry, and clothing for those who had clothing needs.
Currently, they feed over 100 patrons a day and house 15 a night. Big Rock helps cover some of those expenses with a $2,500 annual donation.
It often goes towards our homeless shelter. We use the fund to provide any kind of clothing that men might need or sleeping bags, that kind of stuff.
With 120 participants, up significantly from last year's 50, this year's Big Rock has been one of the largest in years. This week, the boat Inspiration managed to hook the now third heaviest marlin, weighing in at over 750 pounds. For Public Radio East, I'm Lee Jenkins.
For the past 7 years, North Carolina has been aggressively trying to lure movie and television shows to film in the state. Their bait, tax dollars. Since the program began, it's been hugely successful, but the film incentive program is controversial, and in Raleigh there's a movement to change the program or let it sunset at the end of this year. This week, WFAE's Tom Bullock takes a closer look at the incentives program and proposals to change it. His report today looks at how the system works and how much money just one TV show spends in the state.
Standing in front of EUE Screen Gem Studio, there are only two things that remind you you're not in California: a noticeable absence of palm trees, and the fact that the airport up the street is not LAX, it's ILM, Wilmington International. The lot is a complex of wardrobe, lighting, and prop warehouses, wood shops, and production office space. The parking lots have surplus Army trucks and Humvees parked next to pickups and Toyota Priuses. And there's a wooden gallows set up near a cluster of trees. All of this is a testament to the power and allure of North Carolina's film incentive, which ranks as one of the most attractive in the country.
We're actually the largest studio outside of Los Angeles.
That's Lane Woods, one of the staff here at the studio. The centerpiece of this lot, 10 giant sound stages, ready to be turned into any set imaginable. Say, the diner from the popular CBS sci-fi drama Under the Dome.
We know that you still got meat in that freezer of yours.
Yeah? And it doesn't belong to either of you.
You don't get it, Rose.
Yeah, we're in a diner right now. It is the Sweetbriar Rose, I believe. Looks exactly like you would expect a diner to look like in real life. The booths even have, like, sparkles in the vinyl, which is pretty cool.
But here's the funny thing. Sound stages are really just big, empty spaces. They resemble airplane hangars more than diners or a sheriff's office or a school. And these sound stages are similar to the many others built across the country. So why is Under the Dome filmed in North Carolina? The same question can be asked about the Fox drama Sleepy Hollow, the four TV pilots that just finished filming here, and the slew of movies ranging from blockbusters like Iron Man 3 to the comedy We're the Millers and the screen adaptation of The Secret Life of Bees. It's all about the money the state pays productions to come here.
I would say it's 100% of the dialogue with the client base in California.
Chris Cooney is the chief operating officer for EUE Screen Gem Studios.
They have so much downward pressure to produce for a price, and if they can't meet that price, the project's not going to go forward, or they're going to be heavily shopping for other states or countries that can offer a deal.
39 states plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico offer some kind of film incentive program. Here's how it works in North Carolina. When a TV show, commercial, film, or documentary spends at least $250,000 shooting in North Carolina, they get 25 cents back for every qualifying dollar they spend in state. This includes salaries for actors and crew and supplies such as Post-it notes and paper clips to lumber, cars, and equipment. There are some limits. No porn, political ads, live sporting events, or award shows qualify for the incentive. And no individual project can receive more than $20 million. North Carolina's film incentive is officially a tax rebate, but the state can lose money on the deal since it's based on overall dollars spent and not tax revenue. For this to be an economic win-win, productions must spend enough money locally to make up the difference and create full-time, well-paying jobs for North Carolinians that generate steady income tax for the state. That's just what the film industry says it does.
I did a number count on our crew right now, and we have 202 locals working on our show and about 8 people from out of town.
That's just the crew for Under the Dome, where Robbie Beck is the head of the props department. He's responsible for finding the random things found on set.
License plates, people's wedding bands, and for stunt pieces, like if you have a stunt with an axe, we supply the rubber axe.
In essence, Beck is a professional hoarder, and if he doesn't have what he needs in his warehouse, he buys or rents it locally, and he has money to spend. An average of $10,000 per episode for Under the Dome, which shoots 13 episodes in a season.
Just my purchases and rentals would be $130,000, roughly. It's probably more than that at the end of the day, because you always go a little over, like you're building a house.
Beck runs just one department, and a relatively small one at that. Add in transportation, set decoration, catering, and more. It all adds up to a lot of buying and renting, and a lot of dollars being spent. In its first season, Under the Dome spent more than $33.4 million qualifying dollars in North Carolina and received an $8.3 million check from the state for doing so. And that's just one of the TV shows being filmed here. Last year, TV shows filming in North Carolina spent more than $180 million statewide, and they received more than $45 million in subsidies. Sounds like a good return on investment, right? Well, it depends on how you run the numbers on jobs, spending, even tourism.
That was Tom Bullock reporting. Over the last few years, Rivertown Players, an ambitious theater group in New Bern, has presented productions of classics like Death of a Salesman, Damn Yankees, and Pippin. And now they are reaching out to kids in the community with their Rising Star programs. Michael Peterson has more on the nonprofit's efforts to inspire young actors in our area.
It all started in 2012 with the establishment of the Young Actors Academy in New Bern. The Academy was founded by Aaron Williams, who went to the Rivertown's board of directors about starting a program for kids and teens who wanted theater training, and the Rising Star program was born. According to director of the Young Actors Academy, Siobhan Gastille, they strive to give students a wholesale theatrical experience through a series of classes over a 10-month course.
And they receive an hour of training in music, an hour of training in dance, and an hour in training in acting.
The Academy seeks to foster personal growth in its students. Kelly Rogers is a former Academy member from 2013.
I've learned how to work with different people who have different methods of teaching each other. I've learned a lot from everyone else at the camp, the kids, as well as the mentors that he hires every year. And I've learned a lot of different techniques with every day because it's always different.
The Academy meets Mondays at the Masonic Theater in downtown New Bern. On the theater's empty soundstage, the students work to perfect their craft, setting aside their differences in age and background for their love of theater. Director Gastille believes that the environment is beneficial to students.
Because it allows children to really express themselves in a safe environment, and also to learn the discipline that it takes to put on a production is really beneficial for the children in every aspect of their life.
One student learning about theatrical arts is 16-year-old Dalton Daranowski. He has been involved in the Rising Star program for a little over a year and says it has helped him grow as an individual on and off the stage.
It's helped me with being comfortable with who I am and my opinion and expressing my feelings and with large groups or just anyone in general. It helps you just bring out your personality and figure out who you are.
Linda Roach is president of Rivertown Players. She says she feels a responsibility to pass the love of theater to the next generation.
I think it's necessary because a lot of schools nowadays are not doing a lot of theater art work.
Another offshoot of the Rising Star program is Camp Broadway, now in its third year. The two-week summer camp offers classes for ages 5 through 17, Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Aaron Williams is the camp director.
From technical to dance to vocal to acting. It's taking those elements and making them creative, getting them ready for either to go all on stage or to go into this for a career or even go into this to just get some self-confidence.
Campgoers are instructed on how to act in front of the camera, how to take a proper headshot, and the basics of shooting a commercial.
They learn how to sing best for their voice. Not everybody can hit a certain note, but they learn how to sing a song for a tryout that best fits their voice. They learn how to sing in character. They also learn how to pick up dance quickly, because if you go on stage nowadays and you try out for a show, you've got to be able to pick up choreography quickly.
Last year, Camp Broadway put on a production based on Harry Potter. This year, they're tackling Disney's Frozen and Tangled. Performances are set for June 27th and 28th at 7 p.m. 17-year-old Abir Asghar is in her second year as a Camp Broadway counselor.
It helped me become more confident within myself because being in theater is one thing, but teaching others about theater is another. So being more independent and taking a bigger role is what he taught me. He taught me how to be a good leader.
Camp Broadway director Aaron Williams says the kids take away a better understanding of theater, but also learn life lessons as well.
The other aspect that they've learned is teamwork. They're able to learn how to see diversity in such a beautiful way, to love all types of people.
An avid supporter, 12-year-old Sarah Spencer, says she enjoyed last year's camp so much that she's enrolled in this year's Camp Broadway. She says the two-week summer program has impacted her life on a variety of levels.
I think that if you work hard enough that you could become
good actor, especially in theater. I think it's made me open up more and become less shy.
As for the future of the Young Actors Academy, they hope to recruit more instructors and expand their theater training to more aspiring thespians. As for Camp Broadway, director Aaron Williams hopes to bring in well-known acting instructors to teach the kids about theater. The Academy recently wrapped up their 2013-2014 season with a production called Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum, a retelling of the story Jack and the Beanstalk. Coming in October, the Rising Star program presents a full theatrical production of Peter Pan Jr.
Think about Peter Pan. It's magical. It's you got everything in it. You got mermaids, and you have crocodiles, and you have fairies, and you have lost boys who, you know, fight for their kingdom and their area. And I think that we all can relate to so many of these things and smile when we see the different magical elements that go into Peter Pan.
For more information on the Rising Star program, Young Actors Academy, and Camp Broadway, visit rivertownplayers.com. For Public Radio East, I'm Michael Peterson.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with the following downtown Newbern merchant: Four Seas, gifts, toys, and clothing from Columbia, Magalini, North Face, shoes from Kenan Crocs. The Four Seas.
This is Roger Robertson. I frequently travel the roads of eastern North Carolina as part of my role with Vidant Health. And as I travel, I listen to Public Radio East. I am both a listener and a financial supporter of Public Radio East. For the past couple of years, I've also been a member of the Public Radio East Foundation Board of Directors. As a board member, I see the financial challenges that face Public Radio East, and like all businesses, PRE must balance the books at the end of the fiscal year. This June, we celebrate 30 years of broadcasting. We are holding a special end of the fiscal year campaign. Please take just a moment and think about the contribution Public Radio East makes to your life, and then make a special gift today. It's easy to do at 800-222-9832 or at publicradioeast.org. See you on the road.
It's a Friday the 13th weekend, a date when all sorts of strange and unlikely things are supposedly more likely to happen. So naturally, we thought of the Boone-based author Scott Nicholson, whose literary career is based on the strange and unlikely. The one-time newspaper journalist now spins works of horror that often weave in the mountain lore of his western North Carolina region. That was the case back in 2004 when his third novel, The Manor, was published. George Olson has this, which originally aired in November 2004.
Journalism school teaches you to find the answers to the five W's: who, what, when, where, and perhaps most importantly, why. The why behind the story of a Blue Ridge Mountain historic site got Scott Nicholson to thinking.
The actual inspiration for the story came from the Cone Manor in Blowing Rock that Moses Cone, who was a textile magnate in the late 1800s, came up here and bought out all these working people and huge tracts of land and ended up with 3,000 acres. And then the people that sold their land ended up working for him. And to me, I could never really figure that out. It's like they're doing the same work they did before, only now they have a boss.
Nicholson can't answer that question, but it did inspire his third novel, The Manor, which tells of the otherworldly goings-on at the fictional Corbin Manor, a manor whose master, Ephraim Corbin, is caught in a state somewhere between life and death in the walls of his home, where he awaits his return to the physical world. Meanwhile, the past workers at Corbin Manor remain the present workers at Corbin Manor, also caught in an in-between state while their souls lay trapped in mountain folk objects.
A row of crude hand-carved figurines stood on the table, their gnarled limbs protruding at a grotesque angle. Anna touched one of the figurines. It was about a foot tall, not lacquered or painted, the wood dark and bone dry with age. The body was made from a chopped root, the arms and legs shaped from twisted jack vine. The head was a wrinkled piece of fruit, brown like dried apple, the eyes and mouth set in a deformed grin. They appeared to be folk art, something an early Scots-Irish mountain settler had carved during long winter nights to amuse the children. But the figurines were arrayed on the table like religious relics. One was wrapped in a peeling sheet of birch bark that appeared to emulate a dress. Another wore a garland of dried and dead flowers. Yeah, I've kind of adapted a few different types of beliefs, like the voodoo belief of capturing the soul and the body, and then I took the apple head dolls that they made in the mountain. You'd carve the face into a wet apple and stick it on the, and make it the head, and then when it dried, they would all become unique faces, and, you know, some of them look pretty sinister that I've seen.
That's what Nicholson has done throughout his three horror novels, adapting mountain tales, and in this case, mountain folk art, for more sinister purposes. In The Manor, Ephraim Corbin will rejoin the physical world during a blue moon in October, brought to life in a body sculpted for him by an artist unaware of the influence the manor has over him, and with an incantation delivered on that night. The incantation actually exists, sort of.
That actually is a folk belief that if you burn your thumb, you can say, go out fire, come in frost, and then you blow on it while facing the east, I believe, and that's supposed to cure it, so... That is an actual belief, although it has nothing to do with the supernatural, really. I just used it as a metaphor for the spirit.
In the book, the incarnation gets inverted. Go out frost, come in fire, to bring Ephraim Corbin back to life. Other folk beliefs come into play in The Manor, though in their original incarnation and not their most recent interpretations.
Others include the four-leaf clover, which now is a good luck sign, but over in the British Isles, it was a... You had a four-leaf clover, it gave you the power to see ghosts and witches, and so it was more than good luck back then. It was kind of a survival tool if you believed in it. And same with the horseshoe. If you put it over your door, it supposedly kept bad spirits away, and now, of course, it's come to mean good luck in our modern society where we're not allowed to have too many superstitions.
Even some of the haunting events that occur at Corbin Manor derive from real life, depending on your belief in ghosts, of course. In this case, Cone Manor is reputed to have hauntings of its own. Those stories have worked their way into The Manor.
There were some specific stories they tell that I used in the book, like apparently Cone and his wife had portraits side by side on a wall, and someone moved them to opposite walls, and the next day they came in and found the pictures had fallen off the walls and were leaning toward each other. And another was someone took a shower there, and there was a mirror, and the steamy mirror, there was a handprint, so I used that image in the book.
While spending most of his story weaving tales and legends in and out, Nicholson finds time to poke fun at a portion of his own profession. The cast of The Manor includes a variety of artists invited to Corbin Manor, where they find themselves inexplicably drawn to producing homages to the supposedly late master of the house. Among the guests are noted author Jefferson Spence, whose writer's block breaks with spectacularly overwrought results.
And he, becoming night, found his limbs, his blood and joy, stretching across the hills, seeping out beyond the cold dark stone that was his prison, the mountain that was his sepulcher, the house that was his heart. His fingers were now more than mere trees, his eyes more than mirrors, his teeth more than broken wood. He, becoming night, could spread his inky waters, could lap his tides at far shores, could engulf and drown the surrounding non-darkness that no longer threatened. Actually, that one was kind of easy because I could just pretend to be a little bit pompous and literary and definitely intentionally overrode it. In a way, I guess I was poking fun at the more literary community, and is a bit of snobbishness about genre fiction and books that have horror on the spine, that they can't be well written or people like them, so they can't be really good. So I think I was rebelling against that a little. You know, that's how I would have written if I'd have stayed in college a little bit longer.
For all the actual mountain folk beliefs and local ghost stories included in The Manor to lend a horror novel as much credence as possible, readers may notice one aspect thoroughly missing. Why all these things happen is never explained. No pact with the devil, no ancient family curse, nothing. You'd think a print journalist would be all over the why portion of the story, but Nicholson believes in this instance it's just better to let the reader come to their own conclusion.
A lot of times it just comes out cheesy when you try and explain it. It was like, actually, in the original draft of The Manor, I had a Native American character, and he was going to hint at, Raven Mocker and some other Cherokee legends, and so I was going to kind of plant that so people would think, oh, yeah, it's going to be a Native American burial ground, and it turned out not to be, but then I just dropped that whole storyline just because, you know, it's just too cheesy when you say, oh, it was built over a graveyard, that's why it's haunted, and it's just been done too many times, and most of the ideas have already been done, so it's better to just let the reader come up with a new one. Either that or I'm copping out.
Scott Nicholson's third novel, The Manor, is published by Pinnacle Books. I'm George Olson.
one update on this story since its original broadcast. In the past decade, Scott Nicholson has been quite busy. The Manor was his third novel. As of this date, he now has over 20, with his latest coming out this past March, entitled The Narrow Gate. Thanks for listening to the Downey's Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, go to our website, publicradioeast.org, and send us a message.